Line stared.
I am not morally superior.
Dana's brows lifted in sarcastic amazement.
Oh, yes, you are. You judge and condemn every woman at Hanover House who goes back to her husband.
Caroline's eyes narrowed through her seemingly endless tears.
They're weak.
Dana shook her head.
They're human. They're afraid. They're not you. You judged Max for not wanting to go back to a basketball game because it hurt him.
Caroline shook her head, unable to understand the accusations coming from the woman she'd trusted above all others.
He was blaming everybody else for his problems, making everyone around him suffer because of something he couldn't control. He was living in the past.
Dana seemed to settle, even though she didn't move a muscle.
And you're not?
Blessed anger erupted.
No!
Dana sighed and put her car in drive.
Fine, then. See you later, Mary Grace. Close my door, please.
She looked over pointedly.
Mary Grace? Don't call me that.
Caroline gritted through clenched teeth, looking around to see if anyone was close enough to overhear. Dana sighed again, a great dramatic exhalation of wind.
Why? Because the big bad husband might be lurking in the bushes? Give it up. He's not coming for you. You can go back to calling yourself Mary Grace Winters, victim extraordinaire.
She bit her lip, and it was then Caroline saw the tears welling in Dana's eyes.
Because you're sure as hell not the woman I thought I knew. She wouldn't have hurt someone she loved like you just hurt Max Hunter. You're not Caroline.
She blinked, sending tears down her face.
So close the door, Mary Grace. I need to go home.
Seething, Caroline slammed the car door and watched Dana drive away.
I am not morally superior,
she muttered to the empty street.
I'm not.
Seething and crying, she climbed the stairs to her apartment and opened the door. Her coat landed on the sofa, her purse on the chair. Her keys jangled when she threw them across the kitchen, landing in a noisy heap in the corner behind the cookie jar. She opened the refrigerator, then closed it again when the mere sight of food made her stomach churn. Leaning her forehead against the cool refrigerator, she closed her eyes and whispered,
I'm not running away.
Was she? Was that whole bigamy thing simply smoke and mirrors? Had she ever cared two figs for the North Carolina legal system? No. The answer to that question was definitely no. She looked around her kitchen, seeing breadcrumbs on the counter, a knife in the sink, remnants of the last sandwich Tom had gulped before leaving on his camping trip. Her son was healthy, strong, well-fed, and safe. Dana was right. He was safe because she'd ignored the thought of the fraud involved in obtaining his birth certificate, his social security number. Everything else was inconsequential when compared to keeping her son safe, including the law. She was glad Tom hadn't seen her this way, even as she missed the comfort she knew he'd loyally provide. It made her feel guilty, her dependence on Tom, the weight she'd placed on his shoulders all these years. She sniffled, trying to clear the congestion in her head, to no avail. With a deep sigh, she made her way back to the bathroom, hoping a hot wash rag would do the trick. She pushed open the bathroom door and braced her hands on the sink, letting her head hang low. She'd hurt him. She'd cut Max to the soul. She'd seen it in his eyes. And Dana's words began to penetrate her mind. Had she been trying to run away? She turned on the hot water until steam rose from the faucet, then wet a washcloth and draped it over her face. It helped. The pain behind her eyes seemed to decrease a little, allowing her to think just a bit more clearly. She lowered the washcloth and stared at her reflection in the mirror. The woman that stared back was familiar to her, although it had been years since they'd been well acquainted. The woman that stared back had cried often in the old days, in the days of burns and breaks and bruises. before she'd run away. She was still running away. Here in the quiet of her own apartment, she could admit it. She was running because she was afraid. Not of Max, never of Max. But she was afraid just the same. And she had wounded the very man she claimed to love. Letting the sigh come, she covered her face with the cloth. It was still warm. She sniffled. Her nose was opening just a little. Although her eyes still throbbed, they felt less like she'd gone 5 rounds with the champ. Or with Rob. She took the washcloth off her face and breathed deeply. And her body ceased to move. She smelled him. Rob. That overpowering smell of his aftershave. She shook herself, stared at her red face in the mirror, and grimaced, trying to force her irrational fears from her mind.
"Don't be silly,"
she told her reflection.
"It's just your mind playing tricks on you,"
she thought.
"Just that you've been reliving every horrible day with him since you found St. Joseph in pieces. Dana said he's never coming back, and she's always right. Fathead though she might be. Calm down,"
she murmured aloud, and ran the washcloth under the hot water once again. She pressed the hot cloth to her face, feeling the throbbing behind her eyes reduce just a bit more.
"St. Joseph in pieces."
Something had been nagging at her since she'd found the broken statue the day before. Max said Bubba the Cat had knocked the statue off the nightstand. But that was impossible. She'd let Bubba out before leaving with Max. Hadn't she? She breathed deeply again, willing her thundering heart to calm down. And froze. The breath she'd drawn trapped in her lungs. She felt her stomach clench, felt every muscle in her body go painfully rigid. Smoke. Oh my God. Her stomach heaved, and she choked the bile back down. Cigarette smoke. Slowly she lowered the cloth and stared.
"Dana was wrong this time,"
she thought, her eyes locked on the reflection that now smiled back at her. He filled the width of the bathroom door, the top of his head not even visible in the mirror. He leaned against the door jamb as if he'd lived in her apartment all his life. One large hand raised to his mouth, a cigarette between his fingers. Paralyzed, she watched the smoke rise from the red tip of the cigarette, waft lazily to the ceiling. A memory flashed before her eyes. He'd use it on her. He had before. The red tip would hurt. The acrid smell of burning flesh would combine with the stale smell of the cigarette smoke. And it would hurt. Numb, she watched as the smoke continued to rise. He dragged on the cigarette and blew the smoke so that it formed a cloud around her head. He smiled, his lips baring yellow teeth. She'd seen them in her nightmares, fangs dripping with blood. His smile widened into a grin, his eyes so calculatingly evil that she found herself mesmerized. Eyes of a cobra, she thought. Ready to strike. "Honey, I'm home," he sang cheerfully. "What's for supper?"
Chicago, Sunday, March 18th, noon. Dana leaned her head against her apartment door, fatigue finally overtaking her body. The energy generated by anger only lasted a little while, and her anger with Caroline had dissipated to mere frustration somewhere between the street in front of her apartment and the top of the third flight of stairs. By the time she'd gotten to the landing on the 6th floor, she just didn't even care anymore. She shook her head, pivoting her forehead against the steel door. The memory of Max Hunter's anguished eyes made her shoulders sag. Caroline was a fool, and selfish, and maybe just a little bit cruel. She'd always known Caroline was stubborn. She'd respected it, played on it, egged it on. For over the years, it had been the tool to keep Carol going, reaching for her dreams. But today... Dana shook her head again and fumbled with her keys. Today, that stubbornness had ceased to be a tool and had become a weapon. She rested her hand on the doorknob as she slid her key into the first keyhole and frowned when the knob turned easily. A spurt of annoyance gave her the fuel to propel her body inside her apartment.
"Evie!"
she shouted, hearing the edge in her voice and not giving a damn.
"You forgot to lock the door again."
Dana slammed the door shut and quickly applied the chain and twisted the three deadbolts, the succession of falling hammers providing her with a margin of safety. On her salary, she couldn't afford an apartment in any neighborhood resembling safe. Only the chain, three deadbolts, a good relationship with the local cops, and a small revolver she kept under her mattress made her feel truly safe. Evie hadn't answered. Dana glanced at her watch. That girl would sleep past noon if nobody woke her up. Unbuttoning her coat as she walked, Dana made her way to the back bedroom.
"Damn it, Evie, wake up. You'll sleep your life..."
The words dried up as Dana surveyed the wreckage in the room.
"Away,"
she whispered.
"Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, God, Evie."
She dropped to her knees beside the bed, one hand reaching for the girl's throat, the other for the phone. The fingers of her right hand punched 911 as the fingers of her left desperately tried to detect a pulse under the twine wrapped around Evie's neck. Asheville, Sunday, March 18th, 12:30 p.m. The bullpen was pretty quiet, comparatively. Quieter than a weekday. And definitely quieter than the group of scandal-hungry reporters that had gathered for the press conference in the auditorium of Asheville City Hall. Stephen looked across the room to find Lambert intensely focused on typing at his computer, headphones covering his ears. When Stephen approached, the headphones came off, and Lambert looked up with a grimace. "Transcribing the tap on Winters' home phone," he explained. "Anything?" Lambert shook his head and grabbed a cup of coffee from the corner of his impeccably ordered desk. He swallowed, then grimaced again and spit it back in the cup.
"Yeah, God, the only way to make our coffee worse is to drink it cold. I got a few calls, mostly telemarketers. Sue Ann did call her OBGYN, though, made an appointment for a prenatal visit."
Lambert dragged his fingertips down his face and stretched his back. He gestured to an empty chair.
"I hate transcribing. Gives me a hell of a headache. Have you heard from Spinelli?"
Sitting, Stephen shook his head. "Nothing new. He sent another cruiser by this morning, early, but Caroline Stewart still wasn't home. He's left a few messages on her machine, but she hasn't returned them. Any news from the autopsy on the boy?"
Lambert seemed to sag in his chair. "Tony says the ME is 98% sure the hair from Winters' boots belonged to the boy. I knew it would, you know."
"But you hoped it wouldn't?"
"I really hoped it wouldn't."
Lambert looked away, staring at the wall map.
"Do you have any idea what it's like to work with a man for 15 years and then find out he's a monster?"
Stephen considered it. He did, but not in the same way Lambert was facing. Not wanting to think about his own personal monster, he got up and poured two cups of coffee, then returned to Lambert's desk and handed him one. Lambert flashed a grateful smile.
"Thanks."
He hesitated.
"And thanks for encouraging Tony the other day. It's what she needed to hear."
Stephen shrugged, a bit uncomfortable. It was the truth.
"Still, thanks."
Another uncomfortable moment of silence stretched between them. Then Lambert straightened in his chair and ran his hand through his golden hair, mussing it. Stephen bit back a smile. Even mussed, the man could pose for GQ. But somehow that no longer made him less of a cop.
"Did Spinelli have a policewoman call Caroline Stewart?" Lambert asked abruptly.
"I don't know," Stephen answered, kicking himself for not thinking of this already.
"Assuming she is Mary Grace, a male cop might be intimidating, considering everything she went through with Winters. If she's home, she might not even open the door. Also, if Spinelli hasn't been specific about why he wants her to call him, she might not return a phone call from the Chicago PD. Have Tony call, Lambert suggested, then grinned. She can talk sweet when she wants to.
When she wants to what?
Tony asked from behind them, and Stephen turned to find her dressed in a conservative black suit. It was showtime for the press. When this press conference is done, I'd like you to call Caroline Stewart's apartment, Stephen said. She may respond to you when she'd run from a male cop.
I will. For now we have a meeting with a pack of hungry piranha.
She looked over at Lambert, and one corner of her mouth tilted up.
Comb your hair, Jonathan. It's time to face the music.
She glanced up at Stephen as Lambert pulled a comb from his desk drawer.
Thanks for coming, Stephen. This press conference is about the assault on the boy, but Mary Grace will likely come up.
Stephen patted her shoulder gamely. He hated press conferences almost as much as blind dates. I couldn't let you have all the glory, Tony. That just wouldn't be a gentlemanly thing to do. Chicago, Sunday, March 18th, 1:45 p.m. He was strolling back and forth, king of his castle. Caroline had seen him do it before, many times, usually from behind swollen eyelids. Today was no different. A dull throb pounded at her temples at the base of her skull, making concentration difficult. She tested her upper right eye tooth with her tongue. It was the slightest bit loose. She rocked her jaw back and forth as surreptitiously as possible. It wasn't broken. Yet. Rob walked the length of her tiny living room, a gun in one hand. He would do this with some regularity way back then. He'd take his revolver, the one his father had left him, put it to her head, and click, pull the trigger. It was never loaded. He'd laugh later. But she was never sure. Today was a little different, however. Today, his gun had a long silencer, as if he was prepared to fire it in an enclosed place, like her apartment. Rob stopped pacing and smiled at her. From her seat on the old sofa, her blood ran cold. She briefly considered running, but her eyes focused on the gun in his hand. He might not shoot her, but she'd never make it to the door. She knew that much for a given fact.
"I'm surprised at you, Mary Grace," he said, the smile easing into his voice. "You've managed to lead me on a long chase. Someday you'll have to tell me how you managed it all." His eyes went brittle. "I'd like to personally thank all those people who've helped you along the way. All those people who lied for you."
His smile changed from brittle to mere baring of yellow teeth.
"All those doctors who said you were crippled, that you'd never walk again."
He looked her up and down.
"You had me on that one. How many of them did you have to sleep with to get them to lie for you?"
He lifted his brows.
"We'll cover that one later. I promise. For now, let's get back to the main question at hand."
He took a step forward.
"Where is Robbie?"
She stared up at him, willing her eyelids to blink, her throat to swallow, and said nothing. He took another step until his feet were inches from hers.
"You look different," he commented. "Your hair's too dark."
He reached out and grabbed a handful and yanked her to her feet.
"I'd wager it's still that same blonde at the roots. Maybe we'll find out."
He wound the handful of hair around his wrist until she stood on her toes, her eyes tearing.
"Where is my son?"
He'd asked it before. How many times? A dozen? More? She'd withdrawn so deep she'd lost track. Each time he demanded to know where she'd hidden Robbie, she'd said nothing, earning the brunt of his fury, feeling the blinding pain as he pummeled and pounded. She'd survived it before. She could do it again.
Caroline closed her eyes, forcing her mind to calm, forcing herself to think of something else. Anything else. Anything to keep the truth from her mind so that she didn't mindlessly blurt it out. The coal barrel of the silencer ground into her temple and she flinched.
"Tell me, Mary Grace," he crooned silkily. "I know you've poisoned him against me. I know you've made him hate me. You've made him hate his own father. Now, Mary Grace, that's just plain wrong. You'll tell me where he is."
He yanked her hair and she swallowed the yelp.
"I know he's camping. I just want to know where."
He pushed the silencer harder.
"Tell me where."
Caroline kept her eyes closed, her lips closed, her mind closed. He would have to kill her first. She inwardly blanched, unable to dismiss the mental picture of Tom finding her body here on the sofa. He'd find her, dead. He'd remember her that way forever.
"No,"
she murmured, more to herself than to Rob. Tom would remember her as she'd been. Dana would help him through the rest. Whatever else happened, Rob would never get his hands on her son. She drew in a sharp breath as Rob yanked her hair harder.
"You will. You'll tell me soon enough."
He brought her hard against him and ran his lips along the curve of her jaw. She shuddered. She couldn't help it. The cold barrel of the gun followed the wet trail his lips had left behind.
"I have ways of making you tell me what I want to know, Mary Grace. You may think you know 'em all, but you're wrong. I've spent the last 7 years honing my craft."
The phone rang at that moment, and Rob paused, his hands still tangled in her hair, her head still bent back, her throat still exposed.
"Keep your eyes closed,"
she told herself. The phone continued ringing.
"As long as you don't see him, you can pretend you're anywhere else in the world but here."
It had been her only salvation 7 years ago. She prayed she still had the mental will to block him out. She was so tired already. Finally, the machine picked up. "Please leave a message." It was Eli's voice. He'd recorded it for her years before, simple and sweet, so that no one would guess she was a woman living alone. The tone beeped.
"It's probably your sugar daddy again,"
Rob commented, sliding the barrel of the silencer down her throat.
"Max. He knew about Max."
Caroline stiffened, and Rob laughed.
"He called twice already while I was waiting for you. Please call me Caroline. I'm so sorry, Caroline,"
he mimicked cruelly.
"I hear y'all had a pretty big fight there this morning."
Caroline's mind went to Max, remembering the anguish in his eyes, knowing this might be the last time she ever heard his voice.
"Caroline, pick up the damn phone."
Caroline's eyes flew open. It was Dana's voice, and she was crying.
"Oh, for God's sake, Caroline, grow up and pick up the phone. I need you here. Evie's hurt. The paramedics just took her to Rush. Somebody attacked her here in my apartment. Damn it, Caroline, just meet me at the emergency room. She's unconscious and they don't know if she'll make it."
Click. Caroline turned her gaze on Rob's face, watching as his eyes flickered, as all trace of his mocking disappeared. He became angry, and Caroline felt her gut go liquid. Then quickly Rob smiled, tightening his grip on her hair, yanking her still higher on her toes.
"Damn it," he said, almost conversationally. "I thought I'd finish that job. That girl's just too damn tenacious for her own good."
"You,"
Caroline heard herself whisper. He nodded, his expression growing dark.
"Yes, me."
He looked at her, and Caroline's skin crawled. "I put my hands around her neck and squeezed until she begged me to stop. So I did. I tied her hands and feet with sharp twine. Tight,
He yanked her hair.
It cut her, and she bled.
His lips curved, and he ran the tip of his silencer down her throat, between her breasts, caressing the underside of one breast with the cold metal.
Do you want to know if I raped her? I didn't need to. She'd given it away for free all weekend.
He grinned, wolfish and smug.
But I did anyway.
Did it hurt her?
Oh, yes, Mary Grace. It hurt her a lot.
Did she scream?
She would have, if I hadn't covered her mouth with duct tape. Stupid bitch. Then I took some of that sharp twine and twisted it around that pretty neck of hers until she stopped breathing. Too bad I was in such a hurry to get over here to you. I got sloppy.
Oh, God. Evie.
Grief rose up, and with it the need to cry aloud. But Rob was shaking his head.
Don't you worry, Mary Grace. If she ever comes to, she'll say it was a man with curly brown hair, a mustache, and blue eyes.
He lifted his dark brows, blinked his brown eyes.
Which I clearly am not. She'll say it was a man named Mike Flanders.
He pushed his lips together in a pout.
Shame that. I guess I won't be using that name again. Damn, but if that wasn't my easiest get-up.
Caroline let her eyes slide closed. He'd dabbled in it years ago, the art of disguise. He'd obviously honed his craft.
Dear God, poor Evie.
Rob backed up a step, and she followed, still on her toes. She heard the soft thud of his gun on her little dinette table, the rustle of fabric as he dug in his pocket.
Open your eyes, Mary Grace. Let me see those pretty baby blues of yours.
His fingers grabbed her neck, and she gasped.
I said open your eyes, now, or I'll forget you're the mother of my boy and treat you like the goddamn whore you are.
Resolutely, she kept her eyes closed tight and barely managed to swallow the cry when his knuckles crashed against her cheek.
So you plan to make this difficult, huh? Not a problem, Gracie. No problem at all. In fact, it just might...
Caroline gasped again as she felt the bite of the twine against her own wrists.
Make it a little more fun,
he grunted, pulling the twine tight, imprisoning her wrist behind her back. He shoved her into the chair, and she took a breath, mentally preparing for the very worst. But all she could think of was Tom or Max finding her, tied, dead. He'd kill her. He had very little to lose.
Where is my son?
He demanded from behind her. He pulled her wrists behind the chair and tied them to the chair's frame, tugging as he finished. She was silent until he hit her again, knocking her to the floor, chair and all. This time she couldn't contain the small cry of pain. She spat out the blood that filled her mouth. She lay there, unable to right herself, as helpless as she'd been all those years before. No, not helpless. She'd never really been helpless. She'd survived then, she'd survive this time too. Someone would find her. Max would come. All she had to do was hang on and block out the sound of him breathing over her. The phone rang again. She braced herself for Max's voice, knowing it would hurt as much as give her something to hold on to. Again Eli's voice. Again the beep. But this time, it was a woman's voice she'd never heard before.
This message is for Caroline Stewart. My name is Lieutenant Antoinette Ross with the Asheville, North Carolina Police Department.
God damn it,
Rob hissed, and Caroline opened her eyes to find him staring at the phone, rage in every line of his body.
I'm looking for a woman named Mary Grace Winters, and have reason to believe she may be with you.
Lieutenant Ross's voice went on.
The Chicago PD has also been trying to reach you since yesterday. We believe you're in a great deal of danger from Rob Winters, Mary Grace's husband. He's armed and very dangerous, Miss Stewart.
Please contact Lieutenant Spinelli in Chicago immediately, even if you don't know the woman we're looking for. Your life is in danger. The Chicago police will help you. Please don't be afraid of them.
She rattled off a few phone numbers and hung up. Rob continued to stand and stare at the phone for a long minute, his chest rising and falling with the great breaths he drew.
"Son of a bitch," he growled,
and yanked her chair upwards.
"I can't believe this." "Get up," he commanded harshly. "I said get up!"
Caroline just looked at him. Her eyes narrowed, but she said nothing. He'd made a mistake somewhere. They were on to him. It was just a matter of time before someone came for her. Rob grabbed the front of her sweater and dragged her to her feet.
"We can't stay here."
He cut the twine binding her wrists and roughly shoved her toward the door.
"Get your coat."
Chicago, Sunday, March 18th, 6 p.m. "Bitter fold, Max," Peter said mildly. Max looked up from the cards he held, searching the worried expressions around the table.
"I'm sorry, Peter. I'm lousy company tonight."
He dug deep and found a tired smile. David had made a few calls, and immediately his family had dropped all their plans to come to support him.
"You guys just play this hand without me."
With an effort, he pulled himself to his feet, accepted his cane from a sober ma, and made his way into the darkened living room where he and Caroline had made love for the first time less than 48 hours before. It simply didn't seem possible. He stared at the fireplace, smelling the stale ashes, hearing the muted murmurs coming from the kitchen. His family had come without hesitation, without question, without any explanation from him. He knew they wondered. He knew David would say nothing. What was divulged to his family was up to him. What he'd divulged was only that he and Caroline had fought, and that he'd been far too hasty. He'd realized he'd been too hasty a scant 15 minutes after Dana had pulled out of his driveway, throwing a look of regret over her shoulder. Apparently Caroline hadn't yet reached the same conclusion. He hadn't changed his mind, not by a long shot. He would still accept nothing less than marriage. He loved the woman, for God's sake. She said she loved him. They should lawfully be together, husband and wife. He should lawfully be able to smile at her across the dinner table, in his bed. Any babies they had together should lawfully bear his name. His name, damn it. Not the name of some stranger she happened to find on a St. Louis gravestone. He hadn't been wrong, just hasty. Caroline didn't want to not marry him. She just didn't see an answer to a problem she'd been living with for 7 long years. 15 minutes after she'd driven away, his mind began to clear, the hurt dissipating as logic began to set in. Logic in the form of David, of course. His brother had waited until Dana's clunker had disappeared before turning to him, sadness in his gray eyes. And within 15 minutes, his brother had cut through his hurt. Max had seen past his own selfishness, his own self-pity, and seen the courage Caroline had mustered every day of her life. But not only the courage. He'd seen the fear and the terror that had made her afraid 7 years later. She thought there was no way out. She thought there was no way to legally escape the bastard that had brutalized her during her entire adult life. He knew they needed to find a way to finally free her from her husband, together. Anything less would not allow her to marry him. Anything less than marriage would be untenable. He sighed, because in his heart he'd discerned the real reason behind his hurt. If Caroline considered her marriage to the bastard legally binding, it meant in her heart she was still married, still bound, still a part of him. "Not me," he thought, feeling the same pang he'd endured all day. If she held her marriage vows sacrosanct, it meant anything between the two of them would be sullied, dirty. He'd be living with a married woman, and Max found that realization most shattering of all. He'd never slept with a married woman, not even in his wilder days in pro ball.
he had now. His shoulders sagged. Max found he had integrity of his own. Married women were off limits, strictly so. The overhead light flicked on, and the familiar scent his mother had worn since he was a boy tickled his nose. The leather on the sofa squeaked as she sat. He didn't move from where he stood, even when Elizabeth gripped his upper arm and pulled herself tall enough to place a kiss on his unshaven cheek. From the rustling behind him, the party had moved into the living room. Finally, he turned and found them sitting in a row, five pairs of eyes fixed on his face.
"We have a right to know what happened,"
Kathy began without preamble. "And don't even consider saying no," Peter warned. Elizabeth shrugged her slender shoulders.
"It would be impolite, Maxie."
"We need to support you, Max," Peter added quietly. "This time we need to be behind you." Max looked over at David, who just nodded.
"You can trust us, Max,"
his mother said softly.
"We love you. We always have."
Max drew a deep breath and slowly let it out. "If it were my secret, I'd tell you without hesitation. Because it's Caroline's, I have to ask each of you to give me your word that nothing I tell you will leave this room." Each nodded, expressions serious. "Well then, if David will get me a chair from the kitchen, I have a story to tell." He managed a slight smile. "Please be thinking of ways I can make it right with Caroline and get the two of us out of this mess."
Chapter 21. Chicago, Sunday, March 18th, 6:30 p.m.
"Next time, Tom," Barry promised as his father's van pulled up in front of Tom's apartment.
Tom threw a punch to his best friend's shoulder, determined not to let his disappointment at their premature return show.
"Sure. Do you think your dad'll be okay?"
Barry winced as he looked at his father sitting in the front passenger seat, his face ashen.
"Sure. Mom'll take care of him. He'll be as good as new by..."
He winced again.
"Maybe next week. I'm glad we didn't eat those hot dogs."
Tom nodded.
"Yeah, and I'm glad your mom managed to find our campsite. Next time we bring flares and an emergency radio."
Barry grinned.
"Next time we check the X date on the hot dogs," he whispered.
"I heard that," his father moaned from the front seat.
"I thought those things were good forever, Mr. Grant," Tom said sympathetically. "I hope you feel better soon."
He slid open the van's side door.
"Thanks for coming to get us, Mrs. Grant."
Tom shouldered his duffel bag and with a backward wave took the landing steps in a single leap.
"Hi, Mr.
He stopped and frowned. Saying hello to Cy Edelman was automatic as breathing. It was the first time he could remember the old man being absent from his place on the bottom step. He'd check on him when he dumped his stuff, he decided. Old people sometimes fell and couldn't get up, although Mr. Edelman never seemed like a typical old man. Tom frowned when his key failed to unlock the deadbolt. It was already unlocked. He'd have to have a talk with his mom. Her brain wasn't firing with all cylinders since Max Hunter had come into their lives. By forgetting to deadbolt the door, she was just asking the neighborhood gang punks to rip him off. His apartment was quiet, eerily so.
"Mom must be out with Max," he thought,
still not certain he trusted the man. But his mom said she loved him, and that would have to be good enough for now. At least he could be fairly certain his mom would be safe with Max Hunter. Even when the man got angry, he didn't raise his fists. Mom said so, and Dana believed it too. Dana's opinion meant a lot. Letting his duffel slide to the floor, he made his way to the kitchen. 4 hours in the car with a retching Mr. Grant had kept both his and Barry's appetites pretty KO'd. He'd demolished two chicken legs while still standing at the counter before reaching for the cookie jar. Tom frowned at the flash of silver and jingle of keys when he moved the jar. His mom's keys. She'd never leave the house without her keys.
The short hairs on the back of his neck rose, and he looked around warily, as if the boogeyman was right behind him. Quietly, he retrieved his baseball bat from the hall closet and crept up the hall. Bathroom. He glanced inside before pushing the shower curtain aside. Empty. His mom's bedroom. He peeked inside. Empty. He'd taken a step back when he saw the fragments of his mother's St. Joseph on the floor. Years rolled back, vaporizing into so much mist.
Oh, God,
he whispered, his heart thundering in his chest.
No, God, please.
Making his feet move, he picked up one of the pieces lying on the bed.
Mom?
He called cautiously.
Mom? Are you here?
He stepped to the side of her closet door before flinging it open. It was empty. He was scarcely aware of the breath he let out. The last room was his bedroom. His blood pounded in his ears. The palms of his hands were slick. He wiped one, then the other on the seat of his jeans, then tightened his grip on the bat. Gingerly, he opened the door and stopped short. His bed was made, the spread so tight he could bounce a quarter on it. He never made his bed. Never. Not since the day they'd run, because he'd made such a big deal of it. It was just one way Tom had thumbed it at him. Seeing his bed made with such military precision took him back to a little house far away, and his heart pounded harder in his ears. Feeling a sick rolling in his stomach, Tom slowly looked around his room. The old trophies on top of his chest of drawers caught his eye. He took a single step forward as the hand that gripped the bat fell limply to his side. The trophies had been arranged. By date, they'd been cleaned and polished. They caught the light and shone like silver.
Oh, God.
He heard himself whimper and closed his eyes, wishing it was all a nightmare, wishing his room would be back to its normal messy state when he opened his eyes. It wasn't. He'd been here. Here in the place that his mother had been so sure was safe.
Mom, I shouldn't have left her,
he whispered, running to the dinette table. He stopped abruptly. The lid of a mayonnaise jar sat on the little table under the window. His mother used the table to sun her potted petunias. The petunias lay in a pile on the floor, the clay pot in pieces. He didn't need to look inside the jar lid to know what he'd find there. He heard his gulp echo in the quiet of the apartment. The lid was filled with cigarette butts, and the carpet next to the petunias was covered in blood. Chicago, Sunday, March 18th, 7 p.m. The silence was absolute as his family worked to absorb the truths Max still hadn't completely accepted himself. Kathy sat with her head back against the sofa, her eyes closed, her throat working ferociously. Elizabeth openly wept, unashamed. David sat on the end of the sofa, his chin resting on the knee he'd pulled close to his chest, his gaze silently proclaiming his unwavering support. Ma was the first to speak.
Oh, Max,
she whispered, her voice choked with tears.
That poor girl. How terrified she must have been.
Peter cleared his throat. We'll get a lawyer. I know one we can trust. That pronouncement started the comments flying, and Max swallowed, feeling his own eyes sting. The unconditional support of his family was an unexpected treasure in the midst of this living hell. Regret for the years he'd wasted clutched at his heart, certainly not for the first time. He held up a hand and the voices stilled. Caroline needs to agree to this.
Well, call her, Max,
his mother commanded.
She's not answering his phone calls, Ma,
David said quietly. Their mother stood, her hands on her hips.
Then what are you doing here?
She demanded.
Get in your fancy German car and go get her and bring her back here.
Max felt a smile tug at his lips. Why didn't I think of that? Phoebe Hunter rolled her eyes.
And I don't even have a single initial after my name. You tell her to pack her bag and get back here, son. Tell her she's welcome in my family.
She stepped forward to the chair in which he sat and smoothed his hair back from his forehead.
Tell her she's welcome to my boy,
she added, her voice a husky whisper. The caress, so gentle, broke down the last barrier of resistance, and he turned his cheek into her palm, needing the comfort only a mother could provide, not caring that his whole family saw the tears rolling down his face.
He hurt her, Ma, he whispered, his voice tortured. She has scars.
He shuddered and surrendered to the gentle pressure of his mother's hands as she pulled him close to her breast.
God, Ma, I'm so ashamed.
Why, Max?
She murmured against the top of his head.
I accused her of not wanting to marry me because of my scars. Then she showed me hers.
She stroked his head.
It's called a reality check, Max. I'd say it's about time.
Unbelievably, a chuckle rumbled from deep in his chest. No quarter, Ma. She tilted his face up and wiped the moisture from his cheeks with the cuff of her blouse, and Max wondered how many times she'd done that same thing over the years of his life.
Do you want one, son?
Max shook his head.
No.
He closed his eyes against the wave of emotion that threatened his composure once more.
No quarter, Ma.
She smoothed his hair back from his forehead again, and he remembered nights when she smoothed his hair the same way before tucking him into bed. Suddenly calm inside, he waited, knowing what was coming next.
I love you, Max,
she declared without compunction.
I love you too, Ma.
She tugged him to his feet and put his cane in his hand.
Go get her, Max. Bring her home.
Peter brought him his coat, and David stood at the door, tossing his keys back and forth. I'm going with you, David declared. Maybe that friend of hers will be there. He grinned at Max's raised brows.
Well, I didn't see a ring on her hand, and you can't have them both.
David winked at Peter.
She had legs up to her chin.
Peter laughed and opened the door just as the phone began to ring.
Just go. I'll take care of the phone.
They'd gotten to the driveway when Peter appeared on the front porch, the cordless phone in one hand, waving frantically, a frown on his face.
Max, wait. I think you need to take this call. It's from Caroline's son. He's pretty upset.
Chicago, Sunday, March 18th, 8 p.m.
Max closed his eyes, his mind numb.
It's not your fault, Max, David said, keeping his eyes on the road, his foot putting the acceleration of the Mercedes to the test. This is not your fault.
I shouldn't have let her go like that. I should have made sure she got home safely.
That's absurd. Caroline doesn't need you to be torturing yourself now. She needs you to keep your wits about you so you can take care of Tom.
Tom. Max swallowed back his own terror as empathy for Caroline's son filled him.
God, what the boy had been through in the last hour. How soon before we're there?
They were racing for the precinct to meet with Lieutenant Spinelli.
20 minutes? What exactly did the police say? This Spinelli, what did he say?
Max rubbed his hands over his face.
He said they'd tracked Winters to Chicago. He's been looking for Caroline for 2 weeks now. They've been working with the police in Asheville.
North Carolina?
Yeah, it's where Caroline grew up. Lieutenant Spinelli said they'd send someone to get Tom and bring him to the police station.
What about the girl?
Evie? The hospital said she was still in critical condition. They're trying to find Dana to tell her to call me.
David's jaw tightened.
Coincidence? Spinelli didn't think so. He didn't say why, just that he'd meet me at the police station. As if on cue, his cell phone jingled.
A moment of fear paralyzed him as he imagined the police calling him to give him bad news about Caroline. He made himself punch the talk button. Hello?
Max, it's Dana. I'm sorry I didn't call you before about Evie. I wasn't thinking.
He cleared his throat. How is she? Dana sighed.
Still unconscious, but holding on. I can't believe this, Max. I can't believe someone broke into my apartment and did this to her.
Dana, I need to tell you something. There was a beat of silence.
What?
Max drew a breath. Caroline's missing. The police say her husband found out she was in Chicago somehow. His voice broke. He's got her, Dana.
Oh, God, no. Oh, God, Max.
Max pressed his knuckles to his lips as David squeezed his arm from across the car. Tom found blood in their apartment.
No.
Dana's sobs came through the phone and twisted Max's heart still more. Dana, the police, they think Caroline's husband may have hurt Evie, too.
No, Max. No.
Yes, Dana.
But, oh, God, Max.
Dana's voice was becoming hysterical.
Whoever did this to Evie raped her.
Max's stomach clenched. Are they sure?
She might die, Max.
Dana whispered.
She's bleeding internally. He was brutal.
They held the phone in silence for a few moments, linked by a shared terror. That monster had Caroline. He was capable of anything. Max's imagination whipped up pictures that made his stomach heave and his brow break out in a cold sweat. He pushed them aside, all the twisted, convoluted conjurings of his imagination. He didn't have time to think about Caroline that way now. He needed his mind sharp and clear, to plan, to find a way to get her back. Dana, can you talk to the police? They're trying to get all the information they can on him. The images intruded, crystal clear and gut-ripping. He choked on the word. We've got to find her.
Tell them to come to the ICU waiting room,
Dana said hoarsely.
I'll be there.
Chicago, Sunday, March 18th, 8:30 p.m. Max and David were escorted to a small conference room where a detective in a rumpled brown suit sat in the corner and Tom paced the perimeter. As they entered, Tom stopped pacing and looked up. Max's throat constricted at the look of devastation in the boy's eyes, the image of Caroline's. He hesitated a moment, then closed the distance between them and wrapped his arms around the boy's shoulders. Tom's back stiffened. Then it was as if the dam burst. Great wrenching sobs tore from his chest, and his body shook as he tried to hold back the torrent. Max patted his back, unsure of what to say to soothe the boy's fear. His own fear. We'll find her, Tom, he whispered, desperately wanting to believe his own words.
This is all my fault.
The self-condemnation followed a series of shuddering breaths as Tom worked to regain his composure. No, it's not. Max pulled at Tom's shoulders until he could look down into his face. This is not your fault. Tom's jaw set stubbornly, and in that moment Max saw Caroline so vividly he didn't know if he could stand it. How was this your fault, Tom?
I shouldn't have left her alone. I shouldn't have gone camping.
Max grasped Tom's shoulders and shook him gently. She wanted you to go on that trip. She told me so. I should have walked her to the door and checked every closet. If anyone is to blame for this, it's me. I should have taken better care of her. I'd say it's the fault of the miserable son of a bitch you have the misfortune to call your father, David said blandly, leaning against the door jamb, his arms linked loosely across his chest. He was the picture of calm outwardly, but Max could see the rage in his brother's casual stance. I'd say that's the smartest thing I heard all night, the detective drawled. Max and Tom turned, each wearing a glare. Tom wiped his eyes on his sleeve.
He's not my father, Tom gritted.
The misfortune is that he donated the DNA, that's all.
I stand corrected. David sat at the table and pulled out a chair.
Sit, Tom. You too, Max. I suspect this is going to be a long night.
The detective stood and held out his hand. I'm Murphy. Spinelli's my lieutenant. He'll be here soon. Max shook his hand and took the seat David offered. Tom continued to stand, and Murphy shrugged before taking his own seat.
I need to get some information from you, son.
He flipped open a notepad.
When was the last time you saw your father?
He looked up and met Tom's turbulent eyes.
I mean the man with the DNA.
Tom leaned against the wall and shoved his hands in his pockets.
7:30 in the morning on May 30th, the year I was 7.
Why haven't you seen him since then?
We've been hiding. Why now? How did he know to look for us now, after all this time?
Tom demanded.
You'll have to ask Lieutenant Spinelli that question, son.
When will he be here?
Tom asked, hands now on his hips.
He's here.
A burly man with a salt-and-pepper mustache appeared in the doorway.
I'm Spinelli. You must be Tom. And you're Dr. Hunter?
Max half rose from his chair to shake Spinelli's hand, his heart picking up speed as another wave of fear blasted him.
I am, and this is my brother David Hunter. What information can you give us? Where's Caroline?
Spinelli sighed.
We don't know, Dr. Hunter, but we do believe she's with Rob Winters. Tom, where's the car you drove away in 7 years ago?
Tom stiffened.
Mom hid it. In a lake in Tennessee, why?
His eyes widened as realization dawned.
You found the car. That's what started him looking.
I'm afraid so, son. When is